to meet, but it's nice to meet her again in this forum where she will respond to Lebo's presentation. Joan has about 5 to 7 minutes to do so. Just something very brief about Joan. She's currently a professor in the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at the Durban University of Technology. She holds senior degrees in orality and literacy studies. She's particularly interested in working and improving issues related to research around transformation of marginalized and rural communities that uses concepts and methodologies which examine the authenticity and authority of research that is relevant to its needs and in the best interests of the community. She's also currently the lead investigator with a number of people in an NRF-funded study focused on transformative education that looks at a value-driven, practitioner research-focused study that's relevant to academic, professional, and social practice, as well as community service learning. And also, very importantly, she uses in this study indigenous knowledge and the oral tradition. So thank you, Joan, for giving us some time and responding to this to stimulate some discussion. Thanks, Joan.
Thank you very much, Basu. This is my response to Professor Molitsani's proposal to explore the potential for social and educational transformation in rural and marginalized communities using participatory visual interventions and research. At the outset, I'd like to say very clearly that it would be difficult for me to overemphasize my enthusiasm for this proposal. I find Professor Molitsani's call to ground research in marginalized and rural communities in a strength paradigm, as opposed to a deficit paradigm, welcome and compelling. Equally welcome and compelling is her suggestion that participatory visual interventions provide opportunities for social and educational transformation in meaningful and significant ways. I also appreciate the way in which she has rooted her proposal in scholarly argument, pointing out that the current practice is not yielding the results and effects that we all seek. The proposed use of participatory visual methodologies is not without challenge to individual researchers. I believe participatory visual methodologies challenge the outsiders to develop within themselves the relevant perspectives and lenses to access, understand and appreciate the knowledges and skills that are already operating in marginalized and rural communities. I believe that there are many of us in the academy who are outsiders by virtue of the multiple distances which exist between us and the marginalized and rural communities which we seek to serve. I have come to understand that it is frequently I who am distanced and not those in the marginalized and rural communities. This has called for an adjustment of my perspective. I have learned that my perspective can only be adjusted when I physically move myself into the space which is distanced from me. I have learned that only when I am there can I understand and appreciate the perspectives of the community and the implications of those perspectives. One of the most significant perspective adjustments which I have had to make was to accommodate on its own terms the operation of orality, the concept and application of orateness, as opposed to the operation of literacy and the application thereof. I believe that there are many people in the university who believe oversimplistically that literacy is a universal panacea, and who marginalize and minimize the significance and impact of orality and orateness. Professor Molitsani has noted the importance of a strength paradigm and the distinguishing features of resilience in marginalized and rural communities, often in the absence of scribal alphabetic writing. I have come to recognize these resiliences as high levels of orate operation, evidenced by complex and sophisticated thinking in all of material, intellectual, affective, social, philosophical, and spiritual endeavors and applications. If, as I, and Professor Balutsani argue that there is evidence of people in marginalized and rural communities behaving in complex and sophisticated ways. Why then are they not flourishing as their urban counterparts are? There are many who will maintain that the key to this conundrum is literacy, that the problems of people in marginalized and rural communities will be solved by learning to read and write. Some ways this is true, but our experiences of literacy projects worldwide is that literacy, as much as it is a good and a blessing, is not the panacea that its proponents trust it would be, primarily because it takes too long. People in marginalized and rural communities are challenged by poverty, poor health, lack of resources, no decent work, and need solutions to their problems immediately. Writing will, of course, come later as a matter of course in the process. So if literacy cannot be relied on to solve these problems, what can? I maintain that the key to the conundrum lies once more in the strength paradigm. Instead of looking at what people in marginalized and rural communities cannot do, that I can do, I have learned to look at what they can do, that I cannot do. As Professor Molitani has identified, the effective hegemonies, I have come to regard literacy, for all its advantages, as a hegemony. Another such is English, yet another is money, yet another is access to the cyber world. Professor Molitani has identified the effective hegemonies and the ways in which they are entrenched by the dominant paradigm, and in this way create deficit paradigms, so that people living in marginalized and rural communities are seen by outsiders as being deficient. The insidious and exacerbating effect of the deficit paradigm is that the people living in marginalized and rural communities come to believe this of themselves, their epistemologies, ontologies, and axiologies, in spite of the knowledges and skills which enable them to solve many of the problems which beset them. Simply put, people living in marginalized and rural communities find it hard to believe that their capacities count. They lack self-confidence and self-esteem, and they doubt that their epistemologies, ontologies, and axiologies will be recognized and honored in the academy. And who can blame them? Little that they have known and know has protected them from centuries of oppression, deceit, and violence, often with literacy as the principal tool of disempowerment. And this brings me back to Professor Molitani's proposal. Participatory visual methodologies, to a significant extent, cut across these hegemonies and enable people living in marginalized communities to express and reflect upon their problems and capacities on their own terms. Participatory visual methodologies require minimal material resources. They expand the spectrum of expression and record beyond literacy. As modes of record and expression, they foreground performance, modeling, drawing, and visual recording, to which can be added audio recording, as we have already seen. They allow the use of languages other than English. In short, participatory visual methodologies provide a space for people to author their stories, to account for their knowledge, skills, beliefs, and values in authentic ways. No one else speaks for them. They speak for themselves. They are the authority. But in this lies a significant challenge to the academy. The academy is accustomed to its scholarship being recorded and expressed in dominant paradigms. English, specifically academic English, scribal alphabetic writing, and other forms of technologically advanced modes of record and presentation, and increasingly the digital archive and expression. I believe that these dominant academic expectations are not desirable, as long as they are not addressing our most pressing social and educational problems. I believe that in order for us to effect social and educational transformation, we need to challenge the hegemonies which hinder our scholarship in the academy. We need to support in every way that we can proposals for alternative research approaches which will improve the way that we conduct our research. In this, I believe that Professor Molitani's proposal for participatory visual methodologies is commendable and deserving of our critical and reflective support on its own terms. Thank you.
Thanks, Joan. That's excellent timekeeping. And I think that's a kind of opportune moment to sort of initiate some discussions. So I think without further ado, let me just maybe start in Pretoria, and then we'll do the rounds to the various cities. Maybe just as a brief guideline that if people want to pose a question, keep the question quite brief, just introduce yourself very briefly. If you want to make a comment, do so likewise as well, that it's short. So maybe we can take a round of questions in Pretoria. Any hands? Yes.
Thanks. Thanks, Montsani. Salim Akuji from Mercita. I think one of the issues, and I think there's lots of strengths in what you're talking about in terms of moving away from what is conventionally called a victim mentality in a sense, and looking at strengths. But I'm trying to understand how, with the visual participatory methodology, we can perhaps overcome our urban, let me call it, domination of the agenda. So if we're looking at in terms of development, we have an urban notion of how rural people need to develop. How do we overcome that? And how do we ensure that the kinds of questions as researchers that we pose incorporates whatever rural people want? So it's around issues of rural development, but often we find that we're inserting an urban agenda in a rural context, and that for me is the disconnect. How do we overcome that in the new paradigm?
Thanks, Salim. We'll take one or two more questions and then give Lebo the opportunity to speak. Any additional questions in Pretoria? Yes, please, just introduce yourself.
Malika from TUT. The researcher speak about the resources. And normally in terms of resources, I'm not quite sure whether the rural areas are aware about those resources. The respondent was talking about literacy as not the immediate solution to that. But in order to manage the resources, definitely you need a little bit of knowledge to take care of those resources. How to manage a bit of capital and to access those kind of information. Now my question is, if we take out literacy, then how or what is going to replace that? Or will it be possibly to combine the two, whether literacy and whatever that can replace that? Because to me, if we take out literacy, people are not going to be aware about their resources. Thank you.
Thanks. Maybe perhaps one more in Pretoria. Yes.
The other comment I have about the rural communities, I found them very difficult actually to penetrate. So in order to develop a trusting relationship with them, you have to earn it after a certain period of time. How do you deal with such issues?
Thanks. Any additional questions in Pretoria? No. Maybe, Lebo, I'll give you those three questions to respond to, and maybe, Joan, if you feel you need to respond, because there was also a reference to you around the literacy issue.
The first question on how do we ensure that our research does not privilege an urban agenda, even with these participatory methodologies. I think there's a possibility that would be the case. If I had had time, I would have spent time to describe in detail how we approach the work that we do. For example, just using one example, participatory methodologies. The activity is usually that the community members or the research participants or the development participants themselves map out what the issues are in the community. Then they decide themselves, with very minimal input from us as facilitators or researchers, which of the issues is really pressing and that they would like to make a video out of. And they map out their own storyboards, their own storylines, and with input in terms of technical know-how of using the camera, I suppose that could be regarded as an urban agenda. But they do develop those narratives themselves without our interference. If I had had more time, then we could have talked more about that. But obviously, as you rightly point out, there is a possibility that maybe they would have chosen another method to map out their issues other than participatory methods. But we offer a range of methods from which we get to those issues. I'm not sure that that's a satisfactory answer. The second issue is that of resources, that rural people are not really, are often not aware of the resources that they have, which is true. So we see our roles then as assisting rural communities in mapping out what resources, what assets are available within those communities. And asset mapping is a well-established tool and a well-established methodology in terms of rural development. So not only in terms of participatory methodologies, but in terms of just working in rural and other contexts, asset mapping is a tool. What was the last one? Yes, the last one was the difficulty of accessing rural communities. That's true. The research, as is often practiced, is that we go into communities, get the data, and out we go. So what this requires then is an investment in terms of time, and investing in the relationships, building the relationships over time. For example, in our research group at the university, we've been working in the same community now for 6 years. So the relationships are, we think, now solid. And that is what is required. And that is often what donors and research institutions do not invest on, time in the communities.
Maybe, Joan, you could take that response around literacy and its absence.
Certainly. Thank you, Basu Ashal. First of all, I want to emphasize that I'm not talking about leaving literacy out of the picture. What I'm trying to emphasize that we need to foreground expression, people's understanding of their experiences through other modes of expression, such as the visual. Because it is through the visual, as we have seen in the video, that people can tell their own stories without having access to levels of high literacy. Through their visual representation of their stories become known, their realities become known. And this is where the participatory part of this methodology comes into play. Because the foregrounding of alternative modes of expression establishes the authority and authenticity of the people's stories, and it is there that the researchers are then able to record and document, in addition to the visual representation, the context and the detail of those stories. And it is obvious that these stories then have less opportunity or chance of being colonized by an outsider perspective. Also, obviously, literacy plays a very large part in the recording of these modes of research and these research investigations. So literacy still plays a very large role. The point I was making was that from the point of view of those people who actually live and learn and work in rural and marginalized communities, that very frequently it advantages them to have access to visual methodologies so that they can make their stories play. I hope that helps to clarify the situation.
Thanks, Joan. I'm going to move to Cape Town for a set of questions from colleagues there. Any questions from Cape Town? Yes, we hear you.
Okay, I find it very often, even when asking people in rural areas to do visual matters, they're quite nervous of even holding hands. That that's something which holds a kind of power that they're afraid of. How do you get people to relax around that? Because it's still something that's quite foreign to people.
Thank you. Any additional questions from Cape Town? No. Okay, Lebo, over to you.
I think it takes, you're right, they are often quite nervous, but not only rural people, adults generally are very nervous around, for example, a simple thing like drawing. If I were to ask you now to draw, you would first spend 15 minutes looking at me like I'm crazy. But I think the investment of time again comes into play, where you spend a lot of time with the people and assuring them that it's not the technical aspect of the drawing, but the expression and the message of the drawing that is important. Similarly with cameras. Some of the people we have worked with, it's often their first time to even touch a camera. So spending time making them relax around the camera and learning what the camera is and how it works. So again, it's something that we researchers often don't have the luxury of time and the length of time that we spend within these communities.
Thanks.
Well, so more money if there are any donors in the audience.
Good. Okay, I'm going to stay in Durban, maybe give our Durban colleagues, we can't see all, but an opportunity to ask a few questions. I did see a hand go up. Is that Kathleen?
Yeah, hey, I just wanted to actually follow on what you're saying there. I've certainly found, particularly with the use of drawing, that people all over the world, actually adults, are very nervous about drawing, often because they've been made to feel in school that they were bad at drawing, that there's a way to be good or bad at drawing. And a way that I use often to get over that, we participate together. I do my own drawing and show them how bad it is, and then they relax and we laugh about it, and then they feel quite comfortable doing their drawing, knowing that it can't be worse than mine.
Thanks, Kathleen. Any questions from Durban colleagues? Yes.
Yeah, there's one.
Yes, thank you. Please just introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Deborah Bendry, and I'm actually visiting from UCLA, from the Center for Culture and Health. There are a couple of things that I found myself thinking about. When you were talking about particularly the one student who represented the need for this back and forth, that the urban learns from the rural as well as the rural learning from the urban, and I'm wondering with this kind of work, if you have done or plan to do work linking students in urban communities to learning some of these things from students in rural communities, and if you can speak about that kind of exchange. And the other thing that I was thinking about as we were watching the video, I was struck by the capsule statements, one in so many women are raped and so forth. And it's those kinds of statements often disturb me. I know they're important statistics for us to know, but particularly living in the United States, I'm very aware how those kinds of figures fly around, and then people often don't pay attention to the complexity of what that statement means and what underlies that. And so I just wonder if you could speak a little bit to that in terms of your assertion of this process of othering people, and I'm especially sensitive to living in the States where I see how these things have a lot of power.
I'll start with the second one because it's a bit complex. And I have to say I didn't make the video. It was made by a professional videographer. But for me, what I think is significant about the video is that while you are presented with these numbers and statistics, you are at the same time presented with narratives from children through drawings of how they experience these. So you are not just presented with the figures from us as researchers, you're also being told by these children, this is how I see it, this is how I experience it. So the intention then was to say, actually it's not enough to know how many. It's also very important to know how the most vulnerable, which is our children, experience and are impacted by these experiences of violence in their homes, in their schools, in their communities. So I think that juxtaposing the two for me sort of mitigated the negative impact of the numbers as you see them. The first question, a good point, student exchanges. We haven't done, for example, high school to high school students. But what we've done is to take our undergraduate students to spend time and to teach in the rural communities and to actually spend time with the high school students in these projects. So that's as far as we have gone. But I think it would be a good point at some time to have the high school exchanges.
Yeah, could be really interesting.
Yeah.
May I respond to that as well, please, Bebo? If I may, please. Not school exchanges, but very, very interestingly, researchers. I brought my urban researchers and my rural researchers together, where it has been perfectly clear that a great deal of learning has taken place from both perspectives in a very balanced and informing way.
Right.
Another thing that I've also done is I've taken my researchers into the deep rural areas to learn from the children, adult researchers learning from the children, particularly through the medium of performance, and particularly around the subject of HIV and AIDS. And that has been quite simply transforming for the adult urban researchers visiting deep rural areas. And the other thing that I have done is that I have actually brought representatives of multiple research communities, deep rural research communities, to the university, where they have held their own 5-6 hour seminars conducted almost exclusively through the medium of Zulu, where they have shared, with translation obviously, where they have shared their experience of participatory research methods. And in that way, the deep rural has actually informed the university directly.
Right.
So, yes, but these are, as Lebo said, time and money. These are, the first Zila Ikaya cost in terms of research funds 65,000 rand. The second one cost 45,000 rand. And the number of researchers that I managed to bring to the university was in the region of about 120. Then having to go beyond and make this, and that's a drop in the ocean in terms of the great South African scenario. But hugely edifying, hugely informing, and most important of all, in respect and response to your question, transforming for the urban adult researchers, learning from deep rural community knowledges.
Thanks, Joan. I'm going to return to Pretoria for a final set of questions, and then we'll wrap up.
Hi, I'm Faye Regan, and I'm from the HSRC. Just a comment and a question. The comment is really that, that many townships, and I don't only speak of rural communities, but I speak of the very poor townships. You find people coming in, and I speak also of the visual methodologies, particularly photographs. You find tourists coming in, you find different, for various reasons, people coming in to take photographs. And it could be, I think that there's a challenge that it could be seen as very invasive, and sometimes, particularly researchers, could be seen as quite patronizing as well. What are those, I mean, are there some experiences around those kind of challenges, and could you talk more about that? Also, one assumes by your focus on rural communities that it's either utilized quite extensively in urban communities. Can you give any examples of this kind of methodology being successfully implemented?
Thanks, Faye. That's two questions so far. Maybe any additional final one? Yes.
Lebo, I'm not. I don't know whether you are aware about the method which is called MOFO method. There was once a presentation here at the HSRC by one professor from the University of Botswana where she recommended that we also develop research methodologies which are relevant to a South African context, so that we can also accommodate more, especially the rural communities, when we are actually doing research. And she mentioned one of the research methodologies which has been developed by the University of Potchefstroom, if I'm not mistaken, by one of the academics there, which is known as the MOFO method, which actually tries to accommodate. I don't know whether that method is used to give insight into various kinds of objects which are used by rural communities, just like artifacts, handicrafts, and all those. So what I'm trying to get from you, what are your views regarding the development of research methodologies which are relevant within the South African context?
Okay, thank you. Lebo, three questions. Maybe you could answer them briefly.
Yeah. I didn't quite get the second one, but I'll refer to the first one, which is that visual methodologies are often intrusive maybe it didn't come out clearly, but the way we've been using visual methods is that the pen, in terms of drawing, is in the hands of the participant. The camera is in the hands of the participant. We as researchers are not taking pictures of them and taking those pictures out. The pictures are usually taken by the participants, by the rural communities, and the videos are usually made by them. So that way, I think it addresses that sense of we are intruding into their privacy, taking pictures of them, and going to use them God knows where. But again, that doesn't say that there aren't huge ethical issues even with the pictures that are taken by the communities, because we have to make sure that for every picture that you take out of the community, you have got their informed consent about where and how it's going to be used. And the ethical issues around that would require another seminar, I think, but they are huge. So you are right in some aspects. I didn't get your second question, I'm sorry. Did somebody get it? Say, could you repeat your second question?
No, the second question was just how successful is it in urban...
Oh, yes. If you visit our website, which is, if you just Google the Center for Visual Methodologies at UKZN, that's one area where we have used this methodology successfully. But other research projects have also used them successfully. Sonke's Gender Justice have also used them very successfully. They are digital stories and so on. The Center for Memory in Pietermaritzburg also has used some of these visual methods. The University of Pretoria also, I know the Faculty of Education at the University of Pretoria have also used some of these methods. very successfully. So there is a growing scholarship and development work in South Africa that has successfully used these methods. And I can email you a list if you want later on. I didn't quite get the name of the methods that were being used, but I know that there is a project that uses artifacts at the University of Pretoria and the University of Northwest, where, for example, clay objects as well as other artifacts are used to get people to reflect, to talk about, to communicate what the issues in their communities are. So, yes, I'm aware of projects like that. I didn't have time to describe this in detail in my presentation, but one of the methods of using found objects is that of using family photographs, for example, as a starting point in creating new, in reflecting on old narratives and creating new narratives in families and communities. So you can use found objects. You can even study, somebody has studied their parents' living room, objects in the living room of their parents, in reflecting about life in that family and life in that community. So these methods are well established and relevant in South Africa. And I support very much developing, and I was hoping that my presentation was communicating that need, the need to develop relevant and useful research methodologies for the South African context, particularly for the rural context. Yes, I wasn't successful.
Thanks, Lebo. I think in wrapping up, I'm going to abuse my position of the chair very briefly with you, because I think it's a question that I think is worth asking as we kind of end the conversation, but not close the conversation around rurality and thinking about it. I mean, your own position, and we started out by talking about you are the John Dube Professor of Rural Education at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And I mean, my own understanding of most education faculties is that it does not necessarily focus on the rural. And what would you say, maybe as a closing comment, and I think your presentation really highlights the relevance of reinserting the rural as a field, as an object of study that is not to be seen in opposition to, but rather in dynamic interaction with the urban. And you said very importantly that the rural has its own dynamism. There's a life and pulse of its own that we really do not know much about. And maybe if you could just very briefly reflect on thinking broadly, almost futuristically, the position of a professorship in rural education in the context of what you have said about rurality and its mapping, but also its relevance for the broader context of education in our country.
That's a tall order, Basu. But what I'm going to say is that while our policies, as usual, have identified rural development and rural context and rurality as a priority, for example, by establishing the Ministry of Rural Development and something. The Ministry of Rural Development, yes. I think that in taking up the challenge, universities as well as other social institutions are not doing justice to focusing on rural development. What we tend to do is to use rural contexts as the context for our research, but we're not really paying attention to rurality in its own right. For example, those of us who supervise pieces will often say, you need a paragraph on context. And that is the end, that would be the end of where rurality will be mentioned in that paragraph that we require our students to write. So what the university then was saying is that Actually, we need not only interventions that use rural context as context for our or as laboratories for our ideas, but scholarship that studies rural context in their own right, with dynamic relationships among individuals in those contexts, but also between those people and people from other contexts. So in establishing this chair, then the challenge is to develop that scholarship. And as you rightly pointed out, it's largely lacking in South Africa. You do find journal articles that refer in their title to a case of Limpopo village or something. But when you actually read it, it's not saying much about how the dynamism of the rural village itself is an important aspect of this scholarship. So that's what I think we need to be building such scholarship for.
Thank you, Lebo. I think on that note, it's probably appropriate to end, and maybe just as a sort of a wrapping up comment, it's very difficult to sort of summarize what is a very rich presentation, and clearly it reflects a world of ideas that is informed by really solid research in the field, largely from a sort of an education paradigm. But I think what your presentation and proposal is showing is the relevance, value of studying the rural on its own terms. And I think that is critical in taking forward, you know, not just simply scholarship and teaching, but also research and its relevance for policy issues and the broader challenges facing society. I think another important note or message, if you like, coming out of the presentation is really that all of this is fundamentally also part of a process of democratization. It might sound rather ambitious to say, but I think what is critical that comes through in the ideas here is that we need to revisit the rural on its own terms, because you talked about the peculiarities of the local, and what we seem to understand about the rural is often perceived through a lens of what we have received notions through our upbringing and social conditioning, irrespective of wherever we come from. And I think that's quite critical. But I think also very important, and this is relevant, I think, in taking the context of social transformation, is that there's also agency in thinking about the rural world, if you like. It's largely a very complex issue, but I think one that we're beginning to scratch. And I think congratulations to UKZN, your own position, and the colleagues and research teams, and the research that is going on there, including also John Connolly's work around reinserting the value of the oral in relation to literacy. I think there's a lot to be said about education in our country, particularly at the high education level. I mean, you've offered a very interesting critique about what needs to take place at basic education, the school levels, in terms of reducing gender-based violence. But I think in terms of looking ahead, you offer much hope, and I think lots of excitement for researchers, for policymakers, to take up the challenge. So from my side, on behalf of the HSRC, we'd like to say thank you very much for those insights, as well as to John Connolly for stimulating some of the discussion in your responses. And also finally then to our audience, people in Cape Town for attending, Durban and colleagues in Pretoria, and also to the people who worked very hard to put this together, notably Arlene Grossberg and Baby Twala, as well as people from our Deputy CEO's office. So thank you very much, Lebo, and I hope that people in Durban will continue the conversation over refreshments in Cape Town, I think, as well, and then certainly here. So thank you. And finally, before I go, one more important thank you that I always tend to overlook: this man sitting on my side who controls the visuals and the technology so that we can actually all speak to each other. So thank you very much, Moses. Thanks Lebo. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.